Today is Tuesday, December 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A top critic of the Russian government says he has the details of an alleged Kremlin plot to kill him.
He gets Kutuzov to admit that they put some kind of toxin on Navalny's underwear. In fact, in sort of seeding the lining of the underwear.
Plus, what we still don't know about the coronavirus.
When is it going to be safe for babies, for children, for kids to take this vaccine? And is it safe for pregnant women to take it?
And a movie to bring hope. We'll have these stories and more next. Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny said on Monday that he had tricked a Russian secret agent into disclosing details of the botched plot to kill him. Now, to get a better understanding of the allegations Navalny is making, I spoke with reporter Charles Maines in Moscow over WhatsApp. So, Charles, what can you tell us about the recordings that Navalny has released? Because we have not been able to independently verify the person he spoke to, but it sounds from the recording like he just called someone up and impersonated a Soviet spy to get additional information.
Right. The important thing to note is this recording was actually done on December 14th. So Navalny's been holding on to this. Now, what happened, this was done in the face of, there has been a joint media investigation that came out last week, which purported to have identified 8 members of the FSB, a kind of a team that was tracking Navalny, surveilling him over the past 3 years, traveling with him on over 30 documented trips, including this trip to Siberia in August, to the city of Tomsk, where Navalny fell ill on a plane flying home to Moscow. And at that point, eventually he was treated. The plane made an emergency landing, and basically it was the care that he was given there initially that saved his life. He's now recovering in a Berlin hospital in Germany. But what these recordings seem to show is, again, Navalny duping what appears to be a FSB agent involved in this team. It was one of the 8 identified by this media investigation, a guy by the name of Konstantin Kudratsev. And he speaks with him for about 48 minutes on the telephone. And Navalny is impersonating the whole time an assistant to the head of the FSB in Moscow. He's also using kind of a phone blocker, which is creating the impression that the phone call is coming from FSB headquarters, at least according to Navalny. And yeah, so what we have him is that essentially trying to dupe and effectively duping, apparently, this Kudratsev into giving details about the operation. And you're right, we don't know for a fact that this was, we can't independently identify this individual. He certainly seems to support aspects of the investigation that have been put out by the media last week. This is by Bellingcat, and an online investigative group, also with support from CNN and Russia's Insider, a web publication here in Moscow.
What did Navalny learn about the alleged plot to kill him in Tomsk?
Well, Kudratsev, in fact, was kind of the cleanup crew. He was sent to Tomsk to find Navalny's clothes. And Navalny, in his questioning of Kudratsev, and again, he's impersonating an FSB sort of higher up, doing an internal investigation into, quote, what went wrong with the attack, with the poisoning attack. He gets Kudratsev to admit that they put some kind of toxin on Navalny's underwear. In fact, in sort of seeding the lining of the underwear towards, and that this was where the most of the concentration of the toxin was. He also had, again, this was supposedly Kudratsev anyway, say that, ask him, well, what went wrong? He says, well, the problem was when he took off, the plane ride was supposed to last 3 hours, this trip to Moscow, but the pilot made a sudden decision to land in another city, Omsk, a very similar name, where Navalny got treated by, medical professionals right away. They gave him essentially a shot that saved his life. And he says, that was the unforeseen aspect, and otherwise things would have gone differently, meaning Navalny would have died.
Now, as recently as last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin has dismissed any kind of Kremlin involvement in the poisoning of Navalny. Has there been any reaction in Moscow or throughout Russia today about the release of these recordings?
There has. Just not too long ago, we heard from the FSB, which called this a provocation by Navalny. They said that these were essentially fabricated videos. This call to this person, you know, it was not genuine. And this man, they haven't identified whether he works for the FSB or not, but they say it's basically a fake. You know, they've also pointed to they make the argument that Navalny, by using this technology to essentially create the impression he was calling from FSB headquarters, could have only been done with the support of Western intelligence. Mr. Putin, as you noted, claimed that essentially American intelligence was working with Navalny. And in his argument last week, when he gave his press conference, this is kind of an annual press conference here he gives every year, he said that FSB agents were tracking Navalny, but only because he was working with American intelligence. And so Mr. Putin's argument here is that they were just watching him because he was a threat to Russia, but that didn't necessarily mean that they poisoned him. In fact, Putin has always been almost gone out of his way to diminish Navalny's relevance. He calls Navalny blogger. He says he's that patient in Berlin and never pronounces his name and certainly never acknowledges that he's a politician.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow, Russia. Several countries closed their borders to Britain Monday over fears of a highly infectious new coronavirus strain, heightening global panic, causing travel chaos, and raising the prospect of a UK food shortage days before the deadline for a Brexit trade negotiation period to expire. Reuters' Soroya Ali has that story.
Lorries halted, passengers stranded, and Christmas essentially cancelled as the United Kingdom battles a new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. Russia, India, Canada, and Hong Kong have joined the growing number of countries to cut off travel to the UK, causing visitors to rush home and Britons like student Brody to rush back.
Almost like a ticking time bomb, because we didn't know whether it was going to close immediately or when it was going to close. I think we've seen more EU countries announcing that they're going to lower that, put restrictions in place anyway. So we didn't know whether it's going to go now or later. So
France has shut its border not only to UK arrivals, but also to trucks, closing off one of the most important trade arteries with mainland Europe and raising the prospect of UK food shortages. Transport Secretary Grant Shapps said Britain was well positioned for disruption thanks to preparations already in place for the end of the Brexit transition period on December 31st. But British supermarkets like Sainsbury's said shortages would start to appear within days if transport ties were not quickly restored. On Saturday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson imposed tougher restrictions for millions of people in England less than a week before Christmas. People then dashed to train stations to travel home before they came into force.
We have on this new variant.
Johnson said there was no evidence that the new variant, which is said to be up to 70% more infectious, was more lethal or caused a more severe illness. Shapps said Britain was simply seeing what was already at large in other countries.
We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries, including countries which have place travel bans, thinking of the Netherlands, for example, actually have much higher case rates per 100,000.
The global alarm was also reflected in financial markets. European shares slumped, with travel and leisure stocks bearing the brunt of the pain, and the British pound tumbled 2.5% against the dollar.
Soroya Ali reports for Reuters News. The Centers for Disease Control says California has one of the highest rates of the coronavirus in the United States, with about 2 million infections. The web newspaper, the San Francisco Gate, on Monday said that the state's positivity rate had hit 12%, more than double its level back in November. The site also says that over 3,700 patients are in intensive care units, or ICUs, throughout the state of California. Dr. Runjan Misra is an internal medicine specialist based in the San Francisco Bay Area. I spoke with her today for an update on how the state is handling the pandemic. Dr. Misra, where I want to begin is here. We have been living with the novel coronavirus for about a year. And yes, now we do have multiple vaccines that are either in development or being deployed. But in your opinion, what is the greatest thing that we have learned about the disease in the past 12 months?
That's a good question, Steve. So I want to preface by saying that coronaviruses themselves are, they're a family of viruses that cause, you know, the common cold, SARS and MERS. But one of the biggest things about this novel coronavirus is that it was transmitted from a non-human mammal host to a human host. And this is why it causes a very severe disease. It's more contagious than other viruses, for example, that cause influenza and the common cold, because it's very new to humans and our immune systems were just not prepared to fight it. So this is important, as well as the fact that this particular coronavirus has an array of adaptations that make it so much more lethal to us.
You mentioned the lethality of it, but where do our knowledge gaps remain? Because in the past year, we have developed an array of vaccines to treat this, but we're also seeing a new variant in Britain. So what don't we know?
Well, I think, number one, you know, it is a scientific miracle that we have a vaccine in our hands at the speed that we obtained it. But there are some questions about the vaccine, and there are some things that we still need to find out. One, which I think is the most important question, is how long does immunity last to coronavirus, the specific coronavirus with the vaccine? And is this something that we're going to need to take on a yearly basis like we do for the flu vaccine? I know the other main question coming up right now, and they're just starting trials on this, is when is it going to be safe for babies, for children, for kids to take this vaccine? And is it safe for pregnant women to take it? Because I obviously, being in the medical field, have heard so many different things. And I know a lot of my colleagues that are pregnant who are actually, you know, willing to take the vaccine because the alternatives are a lot more grim.
Speaking of grim, you're in California, which is the epicenter of cases in the U.S. with about 1.9 million cases. How did things get so bad? Because currently there aren't any ICU or intensive care unit beds for people who are critically ill. What happened?
Right. It's a very good question. I think we could talk about it for hours. I think what happened in March really quickly, Steve, is that we acted very fast and very soon. And we shut down, Northern California first and then the entire state. And we were really good about it. I think what's happened over the last 9 months and why we're in the position that we're in right now, one of the main reasons is because most of us are experiencing what is normal pandemic fatigue. But the sad part of this is that we're actually acting on it. And there were many recommendations. There were many warnings. Please don't travel, you know, for the holiday season. Please don't meet family members, people outside your household. And unfortunately, a lot of people didn't heed to that. And now we're seeing the results of that. And unfortunately, it's resulted in a very significant surge where we have run out of ICU beds. And what we have to remember, Steve, is that these ICU beds and this, you know, space availability in the hospitals is not just for COVID patients. This means a lot for the patients coming in with heart attacks, patients who need emergent surgeries, patients who are coming in after motor vehicle accidents. This is lack of hospital space and resources for anyone, which is a very, very concept to put your mind around.
And given the severity of that situation, what's the contingency plan?
The contingency plan is you're going to have to start triaging people. So if someone shows up to the ER and you don't think that they're sick enough to be admitted, you send them home, you have follow-up with them. But what happens when you need an ICU bed and there's none available? And what happens when we run out of ICU beds in the entire state and you cannot be airlifted to another facility? That's a very scary possibility. And that's why it's so important to remember that as we are now just days away from Christmas, that we act very responsibly, because we need this to be the last and the final surge. We can't have this happen again 2 weeks after Christmas, because it's going to be a very long and very dark winter for all of us if we don't really heed the precautions.
Dr. Runjun Misra practices internal medicine in San Francisco, California. The Justice Department on Monday unsealed charges accusing a Libyan bomb expert in the 1988 explosion of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. The attack killed 259 people in the air and an additional 11 on the ground. Attorney General William Barr made the announcement.
I am pleased to announce that the United States has filed criminal charges against the third conspirator, Abu Aguila Masood Kir al-Marimi, for his role in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Let there be no mistake. No amount of time or distance will stop the United States and our Scottish partners from pursuing justice in this case.
Barr says that a breakthrough in the case occurred in 2016 when it was learned the third conspirator had been arrested after the collapse of the Gaddafi government and had been interviewed by Libyan law enforcement in 2012.
To the families of those who died in the sky over Lockerbie all those years ago, I know that the small step we take today cannot compensate for the sorrow you feel to this day. But I hope that you will find some measure of solace in knowing that we in the United States government, on behalf of the American people and in partnership with our counterparts in Scotland, have never relented and will never relent in the pursuit of justice for you and for your loved ones.
In addition, breaking with President Donald Trump, Barr says he sees no reason to appoint a special counsel on potential election fraud or the tax investigation into the son of President-elect Joe Biden. This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Ariana Grande has announced she's engaged in a series of social media photos of her and her fiancé and her engagement ring. Grande posted the photos of her cuddling with Dalton Gomez, a luxury real estate agent, on Sunday. The singer's mother congratulated the couple on Twitter, saying she was excited to welcome Gomez to the family. The New York Film Critics Circle has voted Western fable First Cow the best film of 2020, while also giving special honors to Spike Lee and the arthouse distributor Kino Lorber for their roles in a movie year deeply marred by the coronavirus pandemic. The film critics also gave a Best Supporting Actor award to Chadwick Boseman for his final performance in the August Wilson adaptation Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. American singer Cher has called for a gorilla who spent 30 years living in a zoo above a shopping center in Thailand to be rehomed. Just days after rescuing an elephant dubbed the world's loneliest from Pakistan, the global superstar is now trying to save the gorilla in Pata Zoo. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. And some good news: under tragic circumstances, over 3,000 Malian refugees were allowed to return to refugee camps in Burkina Faso, where they had lived since 2012. The refugees were forced to flee the camps 9 months after being threatened by armed extremists terrorizing the region. The relocation was made possible through the joint efforts of Burkina Faso's national and regional governments. And to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with UNHCR spokeswoman Melike Trigg.
We're very pleased to see that 3,000 Malian refugees were able to move back to Goudoubou camp. They had fled violence in Mali, and they've been living in two camps, Goudoubou and Mantao. And in March last year, there's been some attacks on the security post near the camp by armed groups, and they were also threatened and received an ultimatum. So that's when they left to the nearby city of Dori, where UNHCR had assisted them in paying their rent and then providing some water for them to be able to live.
It must have been so hard for them, first to have to flee Mali, and then have to flee from the refugee camp in Burkina Faso, where they seem to have achieved at least some measure of stability or normalcy.
And they were actually requesting us to go back to the camp. So that's when we worked with authorities to strengthen the facilities within the camp, to build up to 1,500 shelters. Some had been damaged or destroyed by the weather when the camp was left empty. And then we refurbished and we restocked the health clinic and the primary and secondary school that are ready to reopen and will welcome students after the holiday break. We also expect livelihoods to return, including farming, pastures, land for cattle. And it's already extremely pleasant to see that they are already reopening small businesses in the camp, including grocery shops and butchers, which is an excellent first step.
And of course, you had to work with the authorities to make sure that better security was in place this time.
We held discussions at the regional and at the central level, and thankfully they agreed to increase the security measures. They sent some additional personnel. They decided to increase the patrols, and we supported them also with some of the reinforcement of the infrastructure.
Tell me about the return itself. It must have been quite something to see.
It was done in several days with a convoy of buses and trucks, but also some refugees also used motorbikes or tricycles. Some also moved on foot with their cattle. So it was quite a vibrant scene to witness.
And then there's the additional danger posed by the worldwide COVID pandemic. How did that figure into UNHCR activities?
So with COVID, we held some sensitization sessions with refugees and also internally displaced people in Burkina Faso to inform them about the outbreak and to encourage them to respect the preventative measures. We also did a number of distributions of soap and hand-washing devices.
It's actually quite big-hearted on the part of Burkina Faso and its people, who are already undergoing extremely hard times themselves.
Yes, this positive development comes also in the context of massive displacements in the country due to insecurity and violence, with more than 1 million people inside Burkina Faso displaced in what UNHCR calls one of the fastest growing displacement crisis in the world. It shows great generosity in light of the turmoil that the country is going through.
I understand there are more refugees who are ready to return back to the camp from the town.
Yes, yeah, so we're expecting the returns to continue in the coming weeks, over 2,100 people, and we'll continue to work with the authorities to organize those additional returns.
Meleke Tregg is a spokeswoman for the United Nations Refugee Agency based in Burkina Faso. She was speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips. In Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast, a news network staffed entirely by women is taking the lead in reporting on women and human rights. Dorian Jones has that story.
Under the mantra, on the path to truth with a woman's pen, the all-female Jin news agency seeks to expose exploitation and violence faced by women.
Kadının olduğu her yerde, yani yaşamın her alanı esasında.
Jin News is pursuing journalism wherever women are, in every aspect of their life, with the aim of making women's work visible, women's existence visible, and providing a platform to express their views.
Jin is based in Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast, the center of a decades-long insurgency by members of the country's biggest ethnic minority. With Jin reporting on alleged human rights abuses by security forces against women, including rape, the agency has become a target accused by authorities of airing terrorist propaganda.
We lived through many oppressions that targeted female journalists, like arrests, detentions, office raids, and confiscation of our technical equipment. Almost 20 of our colleagues have been in and out of prison.
Authorities have shut down Jin's webpage at least 10 times, each time it reopens under a different name. Turkey routinely detains journalists, accusing them of anti-state crimes. This month, it was ranked as the world's second worst jailer of journalists. But it's not only Jin's reporting on contentious subjects that makes it a target.
They're not treated as journalists. They're treated as terrorists. And this is the problem. The government doesn't understand that there is a right to do objective or, you know, journalism in the region. Other reason why women is because, you know, in this last year, we've seen a particular intolerance by government officials of women's rights activism.
Women's rights movements across Turkey have become one of the most vocal and visible opponents to the government as it attempts to reverse hard-won gender rights and amid ministerial calls to withdraw from an international convention on women's rights. Despite the threat of police raids, Jin News is not stepping back.
O korku olayına hiç girmedik bile.
Fear doesn't even enter our mind. Of course, we wish to be able to write in a safer environment. But if you are advocating for a free press, there shouldn't be a place for fear, because fear makes you stand back.
Çünkü korku geri adım attırır. Biz de korkmuyoruz, yazıyoruz.
But with the government claiming Turkey is facing unprecedented threats and vowing no let up in its war against terrorism, for Turkey's Jin News Agency, its battle to bring a woman's perspective to journalism is set to be a long one. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The Antidote is a documentary by filmmakers Kahane Cooperman and John Hoffman and offers stories about acts of kindness in communities across America. The filmmakers tell VOA's Penelope Pulu that their film reflects Americans' collective humanity and empathy.
Kindness is the word that inspired Emmy Award-winning filmmakers Kahani Kuperman and John Hoffman to make The Antidote. The documentary focuses on how American communities across the country are coming together in times of need.
My name is O'Connell. I'm Dr. O'Connell. What do you need? Anything?
I need mental health.
Dr. James O'Connell, founder of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, goes out in the streets to treat homeless people.
I'm Russell. I work here at the college. Tell me your name again.
In Amarillo, Texas, Russell Laurie Hart, president of Amarillo College, helps underprivileged students manage their personal lives, thrive academically, and escape generational poverty. At Peter Johansson High School in Modesto, California, Sherry McIntyre teaches a class about religious tolerance and the diversity of faith in America.
We need to protect the rights of the smallest minority, because in doing that, we're protecting our own rights. We can't get too comfortable. We have to stand up for each other.
The stories go on and on.
We came up with 6 questions that completely informed our creative process, which are: how do we raise our children? How do we teach our children? How do we take care of the sick and the dying? How do we live and work together? How do we welcome the stranger? And how do we lead?
Hoffman says the film was made as a counterpoint to the growing political and social divisions in America.
Those stories are all examples of working to right these systemic wrongs that we call fundamental unkindnesses.
It's, you know, fundamentally unkind to not have a safe place to sleep, fundamentally unkind to not have access to health care. Racism is fundamentally unkind. Homophobia is fundamentally unkind. Sexism is fundamentally unkind.
Kuperman says that although the film was made just before the country was ensnarled in the grip of the pandemic, it is relevant today.
More relevant, perhaps, than when we even started. Certainly with COVID, it was about communities coming together.
Such as how communities in Anchorage, Alaska are welcoming African refugees, or how elderly communities in Portland, Oregon are caring for children in foster care. The filmmakers hope the documentary inspires people to reach out to one another and to feed the force of good rather than fan the flames of hatred and divisiveness. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, has long sought to spread Marxist-Leninist ideology and exert its influence all over the world, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. One of the ways the CCP does this is through its United Front Work Department, a government bureau that funds domestic and foreign influence operations through propaganda and manipulation. The United Front frequently intimidates members of academia, businesses, civil society groups, and Chinese diaspora communities, including members of ethnic and religious minority communities who speak out against horrific human rights abuses taking place in Xinjiang, Tibet, and elsewhere in China, said Secretary Pompeo. The CCP's coercive tactics target individuals viewed as working against the party's interests. These tactics include the release of personal details known as doxing of their targets and even their family members online as a means of political intimidation. In an effort to stop this manipulation, Secretary Pompeo has imposed visa restrictions under the Immigration and Nationality Act on People's Republic of China and CCP officials, including those active in the United Front Work Department who have engaged in the use of threat of physical violence, theft and release of private information, espionage, sabotage, or malicious interference in domestic political affairs, academic freedom, personal privacy, or business activity. These malign activities are intended to co-opt and coerce regional and local leaders. overseas Chinese communities, academia, and other civil society groups, both in the United States and other countries, in furtherance of the CCP's authoritarian policies. I will continue to implement such visa restrictions to make clear that those responsible for actions that contravene the rules-based international order are not welcome in the United States, declared Secretary Pompeo. The United States calls on the PRC to end its use of coercion and intimidation tactics to suppress freedom of expression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.